Republican Richard Nixon beat George McGovern to win a second term as president back in 1972. Here in Washington state, about 57% of the vote went Nixon's way. Ronald Reagan also carried Washington state in 1980 and 1984. Author Rick Perlstein tracks the fall of Nixon and the rise of Ronald Reagan in his new book, The Invisible Bridge. He spoke with David Hyde about what he calls the infantilization of American politics back in the 70s. And the story starts with Watergate, when the world that Americans thought they knew was turned upside down.
The bad guys were the guys with the crew cuts. They were the guys that all the law and order conservatives said we should be emulating. And the good guys, the heroes, were these young lawyers, these staff lawyers. Hillary Clinton was one of them the next year when they had the impeachment hearings. They often had long hair, right? And they often kind of came out of the new left. So the people that they told us were the downfall of Western civilization, these long-haired, idealistic lefties, turned out to be the saviors of law and order. And that's kind of a theme of the book, that after this, after Watergate, after we lose the war in Vietnam and suffer that humiliation, and after the first inklings of the energy crisis, which, by the way, Senator Scoop Jackson of Washington, very much remembered as a conservative Democrat, was very aggressive about. He wanted to nationalize the oil companies. He had a very famous hearing in 1974 in which he basically called all the executives of the oil companies up to Capitol Hill and just read them the Riot Act and complained that they were still making huge profits even while the American people were suffering record lines and record oil prices. But while this is happening, you get a change in the political consciousness in America such that people are really beginning to question the pieties of the past. They're really beginning to say, well, maybe America isn't this kind of magic, special, shimmering rainbow of a country. Maybe it's just another country, and we should begin to really think critically about our flaws and our mistakes.
I have some personally some really sort of hazy memories of this period. And one of the stories that you bring up, this very weird incident that I kind of have a memory of. And I think for me, it sort of illustrated how radically different that time was from our own. And this was the meat inflation crisis.
Right.
You mentioned the energy crisis, but I hadn't remembered that until I was looking at the book. What was this well, weird, just even saying it, meat inflation crisis?
Right. The price of meat in the spring of 1973 starts doubling. And what was so striking about it was, you know, we know what inflation is, and we even experience it a little bit, although we haven't for a few decades. But what was really striking, I'm talking about this level of civic engagement. And what women did, what they called housewives back then, not really a word we hear a lot, was they arranged a nationwide boycott of meat. They said, we're not going to buy meat unless you lower the prices. We don't have that same sense that we can kind of have an effect on the world.
Right.
You know, it's kind of democratic activists. But the 70s was a time in which people weren't taking a lot of nonsense from their leaders. And that was reflected in Watergate, and that was reflected in the 1975, the hearings in the Senate led by Senator Church, your neighbor from Idaho, and in the House by Otis Pike from New York, in which they basically said, look, the CIA has been breaking the law. The CIA has been assassinating foreign leaders. The FBI has been spying on Martin Luther King. Let's take a hard look at the national security establishment that's leading the country astray.
Rick Perlstein's book is The Invisible Bridge, The Fall of Nixon and the Rise of Reagan. And you don't just write about politics in the book.
Right.
One of the things that's so great, it's this thick description that includes a lot of cultural evidence to make this point about
that's how we live politics, right?
And one of the movies that you write about the book is set here in Seattle. It's called The Parallax View, which I'm excited to go see if I can find on Netflix or something. But what's the movie, and why do you write about it?
It's one of the all-time greats of 70s paranoia cinema. And it's a time in which no one's trusting their government. And in this case, they're not trusting the government to investigate these mysterious murders that are happening of kind of off-the-beaten-track political leaders. Of course, the obvious comparison is the Kennedy assassination. It hews very closely to that. But these mysterious assassins are knocking off anyone who dares criticize the national security establishment. And one of those assassinations happens atop the Space Needle. But our intrepid reporter, a new cultural hero for the 70s, remember Woodward and Bernstein, basically witnesses it, witnesses a scuffle in which they try and throw the patsy, who they kind of make look like killed the politician, off the Space Needle. And that sets off a great caper that ends up with Warren Beatty being brainwashed and indoctrinated into the evil corporation, the Parallax Corporation, that turns out to be running the whole thing from behind the scenes.
Warren Beatty at the Space Needle, but what does it tell you about the mood, about the zeitgeist?
No one trusted authority, right? I mean, the statistics were just off the charts of people saying that their leaders were just a bunch of liars and cheaters and stealers, you know? You have Spiro Agnew, the vice president, who's basically indicted for literally taking money in bags from when he was governor of Maryland. And he gets off basically with a plea deal, and everyone thinks that it's this rotten, dirty shows that the system is rigged. You know, someone says, "I got more time in jail for drunk drive, you know, for being drunk on the street than the vice president for, you know, taking thousands of dollars in bribes." You have Watergate, of course, and then you get a new president who promises to be this breath of fresh air, Gerald Ford. And a month after he becomes president, he pardons Nixon, and everyone thinks that that's a dirty deal.
The book is The Invisible Bridge, The Fall of Nixon and the Rise of Reagan. And I want to fast forward a little bit to the second part of this subtitle, The Rise of Reagan. Washington State, again, went for Ronald Reagan in 80 and 84, even more kind of overwhelmingly. But what was happening in the 1970s that caused Washingtonians and others to reach out, to yearn for something that Ronald Reagan ultimately had to offer them?
Well, Ronald Reagan was very good at projecting this sense of blithe optimism in the midst of this chaos. I mean, it was a skill he learned in his chaotic upbringing when he was a kid from an alcoholic home. And he just exuded this aura that he was going to rescue us, right? That was his gift. And he always divided opinions about himself right down the middle. Half the people saw him as this heroic rescuer. And this is even back when he was in high school, back when he was in college. And half the people saw him as a phony, you know, as a toady for power. And, you know, that debate is still with us, that kind of division between liberals and conservatives. And, you know, that's the kind of divisions my work has been tracing over these last 17 years.
And so beyond Reagan, beyond your book, who are the true believers today? Does it really, do you think, divide along party lines?
Well, of course, the divisions along party lines are profound. But what's even more interesting is the way that Reaganism has prevailed even among Democrats and certainly among Democratic leaders. An example I give in the book is that you're basically, in order to kind of be a serious contender for power, you have to mouth these pieties about America being the greatest country in the world and not having to apologize for anything. Very much the opposite of this kind of 70s kind of critical temper about our civic duties to the government, which is to question it. So I give the example of Samantha Power, who's a great human rights activist and Harvard professor who was nominated by Barack Obama to be ambassador to the United Nations. And as a Harvard scholar, she wrote an article saying, look, here are some terrible things that America has done in the past that we really need to reckon with. I mean, things we all know about, you know, being involved in the overthrow of Allende in Chile, you know, testing LSD on army recruits, you know, all sorts of things. And during her hearings to become UN ambassador, a senator from Florida, Marco Rubio, a Republican, says, excuse me, professor, what are these things you believe America has to apologize for? And she has to respond in order to be taken seriously. And this is a quote, America is the greatest country in the world and it has nothing to apologize for. So left or right, liberal or conservative, it's almost like this idea that in order to kind of get taken seriously at the elite levels of politics, you have to mouth these Reaganite pieties has become hegemonic. And that also is what my book is about and what kind of damage it does to us as a country and our civic enterprise when we can't really solve our big problems if we can't even really acknowledge our big problems.
So where is that undercurrent in the 70s? It's disillusionment, but there's kind of a positive patriotism that you see it to it, you know, it with this kind of skeptical questioning. Maybe it's a kind of a realism. Where is it?
Where is it now?
Yeah.
Oh, we see it all the time. I mean, I think we see it in, you know, people like columnists like Paul Krugman. We certainly see it in the blogosphere. I think you see it in publications like The Stranger. You know, think of how Dan Savage, you know, speaks so inquisitively and truthfully and sharply about sexual mores. You know, we're not going to it's with the bark off. You know, we're not going to flinch and we're not going to look the other way. That's that sort of critical attitude that I'm talking about. It's all over the place, but you're not really seeing it at the elite levels where you did see it in the 1970s when you saw senators and congressmen really beginning to kind of root out the deepest problems in the American political culture in very brave and exciting ways.
Just to wrap it up, if you had kind of one takeaway, something that you want people to get from the book, what would that be?
That it's time for us to be citizens again, and that you can criticize your country and be patriotic at the same time. That's a really, really important lesson to learn, and it's something that Reaganism made it very hard for us to do.
Rick Perlstein, thank you so much for taking the time.
Cheers.
Rick Perlstein's new book is The Invisible Bridge, The Fall of Nixon and the Rise of Reagan. He spoke to KUOW's David Hyde. I'm Ross Reynolds. This is The Record.